The sermon is the second in a four-part series, A Journey with Four Spiritual Guides, Krishna, Buddha, Jesus, and Ramakrishna. And stereotypically, many Unitarian Universalists get anxious when the name Jesus is mentioned because of the many ways his message has been manipulated, abused, and used to harm others. As that old exasperated prayer goes, Jesus, save me from your followers. Next week, I hope to offer you some different, potentially surprising angles on Jesus, Rabbi Yeshua, than you have perhaps heard before. For now, to continue to trade in stereotypes, UUs tend as a whole to be as attracted to Buddhism as they are anxious about those who drop the J-bomb, Jesus. And to counterbalance that tendency in the other direction, I often begin sermons or presentations on Buddhism with a reminder that any religion or secular institution, for that matter, can be used to hurt as well as to heal, to put others down or to lift them up. The most recent example I've seen along these lines is a New York Times headline last year that read, "Extremism Rises Among Myanmar Buddhists." Amid hate-filled speeches and violence, a nationwide fundamentalist movement has grown. To share just a brief excerpt of that article, over the past year, images of rampaging Buddhists carrying stores and vituperative sermons have underlined the rise of extreme Buddhism in Myanmar and revealed a darker side of that country's greater freedoms after decades of military rule. Buddhist lynch mobs have killed more than 200 Muslims and forced more than 150,000 people, mostly Muslims, from their homes. So much depends on what an individual or a group bring to a tradition, what they hope to get out of it. Everyone, whether they admit it or not, picks and chooses, conservatives and liberals. So if you're gonna pick and choose, I always like to ask, why not choose love? Why not choose compassion? Why not choose connection and inclusion? And if you don't, I think it says more about you than about the tradition. Similarly, many Westerners who become serious Buddhist practitioners are surprised to sometimes discover that the sexism and the hierarchy that they're fleeing from their traditional, the religion in which they were raised, that dominates many corners of traditional Buddhist practice. There's plenty of hierarchy and plenty of sexism. Although just this past month, I was heartened to hear about the Zen Women Ancestors document, though they're not taking the step of calling it what it really is, which is a Zen Women's Lineage document. They're taking a half step back and calling it an ancestors document. But nevertheless, it's introducing historic female Zen masters into ancient lineage rituals, which in the past have included the chanting of only male names. It's a radical shift. So while I agree that we should be wary of throwing out centuries of ritual and tradition, we should also advocate for retrieving and expanding the sometimes neglected parts of world religious traditions that are more egalitarian and more oriented towards social, economic, and environmental justice. Along these lines, as I described in a sermon here last year on pragmatic Buddhism, westernized Dharma, and 21st century Sangha — Sangha is the word for a Buddhist community — the strand of Buddhism that I'm drawn to, as much as I can really appreciate the ritual and tradition sometimes, the strand I'm most drawn to is pragmatic. It's focused on what actually works in our lives and changing our lives and letting go of the rest. It's pragmatic, it's westernized, it's really open to the influences of the best of Western culture, especially gender egalitarianism and democracy. And it's 21st century oriented. It's open to the best of modern science, especially technology, psychology, neuroscience. In addition to all those ways we're being manipulated by technology, there's also ways that MRIs are showing us amazing things about what meditation brings. There's apps like Buddhify that are that you can listen to on your iPhone that help you be more present wherever you are. So there are ways in which technology is also really advancing Buddhism in the West and around the world. And after all, the word Buddhism comes from the word Buddha, which means awakened one. Buddha is a title given to the historical figures, like here talked about this a little earlier, to a historical figure named Siddhartha Gautama, who 2,500 years ago awakened to a new way of perceiving and experiencing the world that eliminates suffering, or perhaps better translated, eliminates unsatisfactoriness. That's the point. And to the extent that traditions and rituals help with that process, wonderful. We should hold on to them. But to the extent that pragmatism, Western culture, and 21st century knowledge help catalyze that Buddhist end goal, the process of liberation from unsatisfactoriness and suffering, we should use those tools, or what Buddhists call skillful means. We should use those as well. And although there are many ways that Western culture can distract us from the Buddhist path, as in that rat experiment that we considered earlier, there are also so many exciting ways, again, that breakthroughs are happening because of 21st century modern technology in the development of Buddha as a spiritual guide. And there are likely many more breakthroughs to come. Consider this trend. In 1980, not that long ago, not a single article was published in a scientific journal on the effects of meditation and mindfulness. Zero in 1980. In 1990, there were five. In 2000, 21. In 2010, there were 353. In 2011, 397. And in 2012, there were 526. These scientific studies are giving data to support the growing awareness of how much meditation and mindfulness-based stress reduction can improve quality of life and long-term health. I actually had a list in at one point of all the benefits, like just bullet pointed, but we'd be here another 5 or 10 minutes if I were even to begin to list the number of benefits that come from, the science is showing us, come from mindfulness. And you're seeing this evidenced in the corporate world. Google offers its employees a meditation program called Search Inside Yourself. The U.S. Marines, yes, people are getting it, that's good. The U.S. Marines have developed a mindfulness-based mind fitness training called MFIT. And some Buddhist teachers foresee a contemplative fitness in the future, that we'll come to see contemplative fitness for our mental health, that the science and medical establishment will start to point to that as equally vital as physical fitness for our body. And from a secular perspective, some have called the use of modern technology to supplement mindfulness techniques, they call it brain hacking. Such that in addition to the millennia-old language of the Buddhist suttas that we want to keep, things like I teach suffering and the end of suffering, we also get 21st century Buddhist teachings, what the Buddha might be saying if he were born today, such as my amygdala no longer drowns out my left prefrontal cortex. In other words, I'm happy. I'll say that one more time. I'm clearly not a neurologist. My amygdala no longer drowns out my left prefrontal cortex. Prefrontal cortex. In other words, I'm happy. So the amygdala is a vital part of our brain. It controls instinctual responses, what's been called the fight or flight, the have sex with it or kill it part of the brain. This you may have seen this in your pets. This inheritance from our reptilian ancestors can save our lives in high-threat situations, so we need our amygdala. But Buddhist practices can help us from avoiding living in that ratcheted-up state 24/7, and instead cultivate some of those more evolved parts of ourselves, letting the prefrontal cortex take over when it's not being soaked in adrenaline from the amygdala. The things the prefrontal cortex make possible, like compassion, clarity, concentration, equanimity. And to the extent that, and to extend that physical fitness, contemplative fitness analogy that I made earlier, one Buddhist teacher has said that just like doing curls at the gym builds larger biceps or whatever you're working on, meditating on the cushion, all those hours that you put there, that builds a stronger prefrontal cortex. More or less. And related to what all that meditating accomplishes, keep in mind that the key point here, that the name Buddha is a title meaning awakened one. Buddha isn't Siddhartha's name, just like Christ isn't Jesus' last name. It's a title. It means anointed one. We'll get to that next week. The point is that there can sometimes be a misunderstanding about Buddhism, that it's about this having this certain experience called enlightenment, and then it's over. More accurately, the process is awakening. Buddha, awakened one. It's a process of awakening to a different way of perceiving and experiencing the world from thereafter. That's how you then live in the world. As one Buddhist teacher puts it, awake to suffering, its causes, and how to end it. To the delusory nature of the separate self, to how things really are, to liberation. It's about experiencing every single emerging moment clearly, richly, and honestly. It's not about the what, it's about the how that we then employ from thenceforth. Put more radically, the most essential original teaching of the historical Buddha was precisely not to create, a bunch of Buddhists. The point is to awaken, to wake up to the truth that you are a Buddha. And that was his point. I mean, and that may sound like new age and crazy, but that was the point, that you can be a Buddha too. That he wanted you to, he's saying, I experienced these things, here's the teaching, prove them for yourself in the crucible of your own firsthand experience. In contrast to Alice in Wonderland's Mad Hatter, who proclaims, sometimes I believe as many as 6 impossible things before breakfast. That's not Buddhism. Buddhism is much less about what you believe and much more about what you can come to perceive in the crucible of your experience. Very similar points can be made about how Jesus taught a way of being in the world, a way of loving the sacred and of loving your neighbor, and not about a set of beliefs. It wasn't about a thing to believe like the Apostles' Creed. And similar misunderstandings have beset the legacy of both Buddha and Jesus after their death, such as Buddha being called, oh, he wasn't like us. He was an avatar of Vishnu, which is what, if you remember from last week, Krishna was an avatar, an incarnation of Vishnu. And that's really dangerous, thinking that you can't just be, that Buddha was special. Dorothy Day famously said, don't call me a saint. Don't dismiss me that easily. You can do this too. You just may not want to. But you could. So that's sort of what Buddha is saying. So returning again to Buddha as spiritual guide, I mentioned earlier the comparison of meditation time on the cushion to exercising at the gym. And while both are good for your long-term health, help you sleep better, decrease anxiety among this long list of benefits, they are also both work and take discipline. And we all know this, right? That's why we aren't all Buddhas, that it's hard. To quote a contemporary teacher, if a vacation banishes all cares from the mind, a meditation retreat puts them all right back in front of you, because you're just sitting there on the cushion and learning that whatever comes to mind, you practice that gentle release. As one of my mentors used to say, practice doesn't make perfect, it makes permanent. And that's what you're doing on the cushion, is you're practicing, you're inculcating that habit of turning not to your amygdala, not to freaking out, not to having sex with it, or, fleeing or fighting, to you're practicing letting go and giving compassion and clarity and connection and equanimity a chance. And we often need to supplement the bumper sticker Buddhism of be here now. That's valuable and can get us a certain extent, but we need to supplement be here now with strive diligently to gain your liberation. We need some more strive diligently sometimes, and I think in our Buddhist circles. Because meditation isn't about zoning out. It's about penetrating deeply into the truth of your everyday experience and reality, what's sometimes called insight. And it's about strengthening your prefrontal cortex, what's sometimes called concentration, so that it comes to be second nature for everyday life, not to trigger your amygdala, the fight or flight reptile part of the brain, but for our second nature to become characteristics such as compassion, clarity, equanimity, irrespective of what rises in our experience. To make that same point from a slightly different angle, the most important part of becoming a Buddha isn't some blissed out unitive experience that happens on a meditation mat, as wonderful as that those sort of blissed out moments can be. It's about integrating the fruit of your practice into everyday life. It's about bringing that mat experience into the rest of your life. bringing compassion, clarity, and connection into your relationship with yourself, bringing clarity, compassion, and connection into your relationship with your family, your friends, and your colleagues, bringing clarity, compassion, and connection into your relationship with this one planet and with our place in the universe. So if you do strive diligently in Buddhist practices to gain your liberation, it's vital to also remember that the end game of that is not that your life will be perfect. Because if that's what you think, you're going to be disappointed at the end. Whatever that would even mean to have your life be perfect. I honestly don't. There's a sermon in that I'll preach later that I don't even know what that would mean to have a perfect life. But a central Buddhist teaching is that everything is impermanent. Everything dies and passes away. Science teaches us that same truth, that even things like this pulpit, which seem awfully sturdy, if we were to set this pulpit out in the lawn and do a time-lapse photography over it over the course of a year, you would see it begin to pass away. The same with us, the same with this planet. Everything is in the process of changing, evolving, and dying. Everything in the universe is arising and passing away. In the end, entropy wins. We can't change impermanence, but the Buddhist path invites us to consider that the most sane response, the response to impermanence that is most in touch with reality as it actually is, might be to accept that truth and concentrate on what we still do, despite that truth, have some control over. And that is our response, acting out of our prefrontal cortex, not our amygdala, acting out of our potential for bringing compassion, clarity, and connection to whatever comes our way. From the Buddhist perspective, the only alternative to this choice is to resist the truth of impermanence, that whether we like it or not, impermanence is the case, and if we try to resist it and let our amygdala guide us instead of Buddha, we create more suffering for ourselves, for those around us, and for this planet. Remember from the spoken meditation about the rat who was manipulated by that variable reward system, such that he just stood there all day, pulling the lever. Well, a Buddhist monk once described our situation as humans as being like that of a donkey tethered to a cart, with a carrot dangling just in front of his face. The donkey strives for that carrot, pulling the cart along, convinced that if he can just get a bite, the donkey will be happy. When really, of course, what would make the donkey happiest would be to just set that burden down. The Buddha, as spiritual guide, invites us to lay our burden down, to step off the wheel of seeking perfection, to learn to go with the flow of impermanence, which is what the underlying truth of our reality is, whether we like it or not. But Buddhism doesn't just teach impermanence, it teaches interconnectedness of all reality, what our UU's seventh principle calls the interdependent web of all existence. Leonard Cohen says it this way: if you don't become the ocean, you'll be seasick every day. In that spirit, I'd like to invite us to continue to experiment with experiencing Buddha as our spiritual guide. You can remain seated, turn in your teal hymnal to 1031, and again, I want you to really experiment with setting your intention as you sing these verses. What does it feel like to sing and really mean it for yourself, to wish for yourself well-being and peace? And then what does it feel like to extend that and change that to you, to the other people in this room, maybe setting your intention to those sitting beside you? And then how does it feel to make that shift to we, to offering that wish for peace and well-being to all beings?